Welcome to the next installment of the Science Progress interview series. I'm Andrew Pratt, and today we are talking with Eric Grosten, who is a senior associate at the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions here in Washington, D.C. And Eric has authored a new book called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. And we're basically here today to talk about carbon in many different forms and how it's connected to evolutionary systems, how it's connected to climate change, and how it underscores a lot of the science that's changing the way we think about everyday life. And so this is a big, complicated book, Aaron. Again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to sort of start off because you pick up a lot of these threads and condense them in a really interesting way at the beginning of the book. And so in the prologue, you quote Shirley Ann Jackson, who's the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, who has said that a number of important questions that are only able to be addressed at the nexus of life sciences with the physical, computational, and information sciences. And you later write that the biological and computational sciences are actually evolving into sort of an uber science. And my question is, you know, how will these convergences of scientific research tell us more about the natural world? And will they actually be able to let us make smarter policy solutions?
I think that, yes, we're learning about the natural world at a clip that is just accelerating. And they will help us make smarter policy solutions. So the answer to the question is actually yes. Now, what's extremely noteworthy is something we've seen in the last year, and that is the scientific community really getting its act together and realizing that they need to play a bigger role in policy, and that the if they're not communicating to the public and to policymakers and not informing everyone what their observations of the natural world are, then our policy won't be based on what's occurring in the natural world. This is something I think about frequently. This is an article from Physics Today from June 2007, and it's about Dwight Eisenhower and his scientists. And shortly before his death in 1969, he told a friend of his, they were talking about what Eisenhower called my scientists, and he said, "You know, Jim, this bunch of scientists was one of the few groups that I encountered in Washington who seemed to be there to help the country and not help themselves." And there is that element of scientists are curious about how the world works and try to explain it to the best of our ability. So what's important is linkage between studying about the natural world and making smarter policy decisions. And actually, so you introduced me about my work at the Nicholas Institute, and we actually exist to take science and help bring it to Washington and inform policy. So this is a linkage that's growing.
Now, you in the book, you end up talking with people who are working across a huge swath of scientific research. Do you find yourself working with those same sort of groups and coming together at these intersections in your work at the Nicholas Institute?
Yeah, one thing that we're seeing in universities, possibly more than any other place, is the emergence of new disciplines and the emergence of new categories of thought. And the carbon age is sort of my attempt to say, look, we divide the world and our experience into administrative and intellectual categories of thought that are dozens or in some cases hundreds of years old. And the science we understand now no longer justifies a lot of these categories. So the book is my attempt to say, all right, let's just take a breather here for a second. Let's peel back some of these categories, look at something very fundamental, and see if we can't come up with a way to rethink the way we think about the world. And so if you retreat to carbon, which is the central structural element of all life and civilization, and you build up from there, you see that energy and climate and personal health and industrial materials are all far more related and interconnected than we give them credit for.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, one of the places that people probably hear about carbon most often in media and mainstream discussion is in talking about climate change. And I want to bring up a little bit of research from the Pew Research Center. Now, there's some recent survey data from them indicating that the proportion of U.S. citizens who say that there is solid evidence of global warming has dropped since the beginning of last year and is about where it was at the beginning of last summer, the summer of 2006. And what's more, less than half of the U.S. population, only 47%, believes that global warming is caused by humans. Now, as someone who is now an expert on carbon, atmospheric and otherwise, how, at this moment in time, do you go about explaining the fact that humans are the cause of global warming?
The easiest answer is in the IPCC report. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the consortium of 3,000 scientists that over the past 20 years have produced four reports, reviews of everything we know about climate science. So obviously our listeners can't see these graphs, but they actually can. What I'm showing here are figure. Well, first, if you go to www.ipcc.ch and you click on the Working Group 1 IPCC report, this is the physical science basis of climate change. You go into Chapter 9. Sorry to take up the time.
No.
But I want people to literally be on the same page with
these
us here.
These are important documents.
Yeah. And you can actually, there's a file that says figures at the bottom of the page. And so these are figures 9.4 and figure 9.5 from the Chapter 9 of Working Group 1 of the 2007 IPCC report. So there's one graph in figure 9.5 at the bottom of the slide that shows the amount of climate change from natural forcings. And the two biggest natural forcings are generally volcanoes, first and foremost, and solar variability. So if you graph only what we know about CO2 coming from volcanoes and solar variability, you can't even begin to really see an increase in temperature. There's the tremendous gap in this graph between observed natural forcings and observed temperature increases. So in the graph above this, you add in anthropogenic forcings or man-made forcings. And once you add the man-made gases on top of these natural forcings, it's identical to the temperature rise. So science moves forward and is emboldened by correlations. Correlations from fields that have nothing to do with each other, correlations from people who have never spoken, correlations among within and outside of disciplines. And generally, that's where the strength comes from, is we've seen this temperature rise. We know these natural forcings have occurred, and we know these unnatural forcings have occurred, and they match. The prediction matches, and that's what makes science trustworthy.
No, it seems like a really important point to make. Well, I want to actually sort of connect this to another somewhat controversial scientific area that's generating a lot of discussion. You actually straddle, as I've been saying, a huge breadth of scientific research and actually draw connections between disciplines like evolutionary biology, synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and climate change, as we've talked about. And the link between them, the thread, is, of course, carbon. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this particular connection can allow us to communicate more effectively in public debates about, say, how to teach evolution or respond to climate change, mm-hmm. as we've been talking about.
It's a good question, and it goes to the very heart of this project. And I used to write for Time magazine, and this book emerged after I'd been there a couple of years and said, I did spend a lot of time covering energy and climate, but since it was it's a general interest news magazine, so you end up covering a lot of things. And after a few years, I had covered a lot of things. And I began to ask myself, how could I make sense of everything I'm covering? And at the end of 2003, climate change was picking up steam in the private sector. Energy prices were on their rise. The price of oil had begun its steady ascent. Lance Armstrong was riding to victory every year on a $6,500 carbon fiber bicycle, and the Atkins diet, you know, with the low carb diet, was careening toward its spectacular blowout. So I said, okay, well, it's going to be carbon. That's going to be my tool for probing all of these things I've covered. And I wasn't a science writer before this. I was a business and technology journalist who had a lot of questions about science. So once I went back to the carbon atom as a unifying explainer, from there, I ended up writing a book. Much to my surprise, I had no idea what this book was going to look like. It's just, you know, 3 years of research took me in this direction. So once you have the carbon atom, it bonds with other carbon atoms out in space. They bond with other kinds of atoms. You accrete into big clouds, and they condense into new stars and planets. And, you know, it turns into a book about old Earth geology and the origin of life and evolution, evolution's effect on the global carbon cycle. And that's how the book took its shape. So I also realized you can't, there's no reason to call these scientific disciplines what scientists call them. Like, who cares what scientists call them? I'll get in trouble for saying that. But, you know, I'm holding, another thing I'm holding here is the National Smart Grant Department of Education Fields of Study list of majors that students who study these things can apply for.
This is a long
list. Grants. This is a very long list. And this list became famous or infamous in early 2006 when it became clear that the Department of Education had removed evolutionary biology from the list. Oh. It had since been added on. But you go through this list, and there is, unless you are majoring in one of these things, there's no reason for guys like you and me to distinguish between biochemistry, molecular biochemistry, molecular biophysics, structural biology, photobiology. It goes on and on and on. So what I decided to do is just say, okay, just like skip that. How would we talk about this like we were not scientists? And the way you do it is you say, all right, let's just call it carbon science. And if you do that, you just follow the carbon out of the volcano into the atmosphere, down into a plant, into our stomach. You know, we pass away and bacteria go at us. It goes back into the atmosphere, eventually washes into the ocean, down into sediment where it gets, you know, subducted into the Earth mantle. By following the carbon, it allows you to restructure and give us a dynamic rather than a static picture of how the world works and how various parts of our experience correlate.
And I think that cycle that you're describing is incredibly interesting because it allows you to pick up some really intriguing metaphors. You write that anthropogenic global warming erases the line between biological and geological timescale as vividly as anything else humans do on the planet. And you have this great quote from Scott Wing of the Smithsonian Institution who basically says, "We are plate tectonics." So I have this question. How do you think, based on what you're saying, we have to rethink these distinctions between disciplines and between ideas of sort of natural and unnatural planetary events and natural and unnatural disruptions to the carbon cycle?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that happens if you start to challenge the way we think about things is you see the bigger picture and you see how behaviors in certain part of the world or in certain industries affect the whole world. This is a headline from a magazine a couple of years ago. It doesn't even matter. This is a teaser at the front of a section for a list for a series of book reviews about economics books. This is when Freakonomics had just coming out, and there were a number of top selling books on economics. So the teaser was, guess what the hottest new science book fad is? Here's a hint: it's not geology. And that's great. That's a perfectly acceptable teaser for to get you into this series of book reviews about economics. The problem isn't with that headline. The problem is that we don't see economics and geology as the same thing. Like, what are people going to think 50 years from now when they look back and say, this is a civilization of people who were completely bored out of their skulls by biology, by geology, yet excavated carbon minerals out of the ground to make their economy run? Economics is geology. It's powered by rocks we pull out of the ground. So that's one example, and the practical repercussions of drawing this distinction between economics and geology is that we only have a price tag on what we get out of the ground. So when we burn that into atmospheric gas, it no longer has any value to the economy, and that's changing, and that's where federal and international carbon emissions trading policy is going to solve this question.
Now, you come up with another great metaphor when you're discussing the Stern Report and other economic analysis of climate change, and say that chronic illness is to personal income what global warming is to economic output. So in the future, we're really going to have to think, or in the present, we're going to have to think critically about what a future where we continue to separate our understanding of geology and our understanding of economics, and keeping them in separate bins is not going to get us to the right place.
That's not going to get us to the right place. That's absolutely correct. And there's been a lot of interesting papers by a number of economists around the country and around the world in the last couple of years. Here's how I would frame an answer to this question: economists have a much harder job than carbon cycle Earth geophysicists and geochemists have, because the Earth is a very complicated thing, but it's consistent. Like, carbon has always flowed through the Earth in the same way. Plate tectonics have always reshaped the continents. So you can build models that are very powerful because these Earth processes are predictable. Economists have to do two things. They have to build models of how groups of people behave, and no one really knows how to do that with the same precision that geophysicists can do it. So economists are in this unenviable position of having to build a model on top of the science model, and that puts them, it adds more variables into their mix and into their analyses. So for me, it's a little weird that so many people doubt climate science, but economists have as much influence as they do. Because when you look at it from this perspective, economists have a much harder job to do, and I don't envy them, and I'm not putting them down, because I work with economists, and these are some of the smartest people I know working on some of the hardest problems ever conceived. So in the last year or two, you have a number of people, like Martin Weitzman in particular at Harvard University, who have said, you know what, maybe neoclassical economics actually isn't suited for a problem as big as climate change. Global warming is a unique geological event with massive uncertainties that we need to think about, even if they're not going to occur for another 50 or 100 years. So your original question is, how can scientists and economists, how do they think about things differently? There's a huge gap between how scientists and economists think about climate. And I think it's because they don't talk to each other as much as you would think. And at the center of their discussion that they're not having enough of is probably the central question of climate change, which is, what does the current generation owe the future generation? How do we value the future? Because then going back into economics, that question, how do we value the future, is literally, it's a variable in an equation that economists use in cost-benefit analyses to determine how much a climate change policy will cost. And you alluded to the Stern report. The big debate in economics in the last 2 years has been, well, the Stern report broke with economic tradition by choosing a variable in this equation that places a very high value on the future. And the Stern report, because of that, has a recommendation that we should do as much as possible right now because it will be cheaper to act now than to wait and let richer future generations deal with it. And that is entering the public sphere slowly. It hasn't gotten to policymakers yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a question about those choices, about what we do now. There's some people who work in energy and climate policy, and they talk about what's termed in different places as the technology trap, this idea that the solution to climate change is breakthrough technologies like hydrogen-powered cars and so forth. You know, how do we need to think about science, and how do we need to think about technology, you know, in terms of getting us out of this mess?
Mm-hmm. Since there's never been anything like climate change, with definitely the exception of the threat of nuclear war, this is an all-hands-on-deck affair, and we need to fundamentally change the way we behave in a lot of ways in order to have what will be interpreted by future generations as a real attempt at dealing with climate change. So I think it's easy to fall into the technology trap or fall into any little trap along the way that makes climate change seem like something you can parcel from just in one aspect of our experience and one aspect of our national governance, when in fact we really have to reach for every possible technology that might work. One area of conflict, for example, is there's a number of firms and scientists who are trying to experiment with pouring iron into the ocean. So that catalyzes biological activity and draws carbon down into the atmosphere. And
sort of a geoengineering
solution? Yes, this is one of the more prominent geoengineering solutions. And this, a lot of marine biologists go absolutely nuts. I don't want to characterize them as going absolutely nuts because they're conducting research and showing that, you know, this can have negative effects. This can add carbon to the atmosphere. This may have no net gain in terms of the air-sea interaction and the transport of carbon between them. I read all the papers that come out, and I have talked to some of the people who run these companies, and it's easy to come to the conclusion that we just need to try everything because business as usual will take the climate of places humans have settled for 8 to 10,000 years and make those no longer good places to have settlements. That's what we're up against here, and I think that scale gets lost in the noise of, you know, daily media and all the things we pay attention to and talk about at cocktail parties.
No, I think that point about scale is really important. Well, we've covered a whole lot of ground. Are there any sort of closing thoughts on carbon that you think are important to people to hold in their mind when they're thinking about energy and environmental policy?
I think it's you can tell a big story. You can tell a singular story about our experience by looking at carbon. And as I said earlier, energy and climate and personal health and pharmaceuticals and industrial materials, all of these topics that we treat as stovepipe categories all become episodes in this grand story of the carbon cycle. So as a book, I hope people enjoy it. I spent a lot of time taking a lot of material and just trying to make it fun and easy to read. But it's also, hopefully, you know, an organizing tool for thinking about how we think about things.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you again. We've been talking with Eric Rosten. He's the author of The Carbon Age. Thanks for coming in today, Eric.
Thank you.